Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Human Rights, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Rin Beath, a host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Florence Ashley about their new book, Banning Transgender Conversion Practices, a Legal and Policy Analysis. Florence Ashley, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I'm a trans feminine jurist and bioethicist. I'm currently doing my doctorate at the University of Toronto Faculty of Law and Joint Center for Bioethics. I work across a pretty wide range of topics and issues, mostly focusing on trans health, but really being a little bit all over the place in bioethics, in healthcare, in law, and sometimes in more kind of cultural, like sociological aspects. And I also collaborate on various empirical research projects on usually in transgender health.
Fantastic. And I would just say, I mean, for those who are not familiar with your work, you are one of the busiest scholars, academics I know. I feel like you're constantly putting out new papers or participating in new projects. So I'm so excited to speak with you. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you came to write Banning Transgender Conversion Practices.
Yeah, so this book project really started from my master's degree. And initially, I wanted to write my master's on gatekeeping and access to hormones from a legal perspective. But then I worked on conversion practices for just a master's class that I took and really felt the need for this work and reoriented my master's around that. And a big part of the motivation is that, you know, being trans, so many people around me have experienced conversion practices. So many of my friends, of my partners, and everybody around me. And so not only do I feel the burden in terms of, you know, what it says socially for trans people and for myself, that we have this really prominent practice that's predicated on the idea that there's something wrong with being trans and really contributes socially to this idea. And we see it everywhere, people referring to these practices as a justification for mistreating trans people. So not only was there that, but then also the broader impact on trans communities, because we depend on each other for life-sustaining work, for support. And when such a huge portion of the community suffers just immense trauma, it impacts, you know, everybody. And being also next to them, I see their pain and their trauma. And I see a policy world and a cultural world that doesn't really seem to care and that doesn't really seem to take their pain seriously. And, you know, I didn't know this was going to become a book when I started, but I thought, hey, maybe I can, you know, do my little part to help on that. Knowing that as, you know, a trans scholar in law, there are very, very, very few people who can do this sort of work. And so I did my master's, and via my master's started becoming increasingly involved in supporting survivors who were fighting to get the practices banned. And through my work with them, got an immense amount of feedback that made my work, you know, a billion times better, but also through that feedback really realized the importance of that work and the need that there was for that work, because survivors have an immense amount of knowledge and skill, but few of them have it in the legal policy world. And so having somebody who can translate their knowledge into words that are understandable to policymakers and to lawmakers, that speak their language, that speak this language of the law, is really valuable and is really how I see my own work. Like, I do translation. All of my work is translation, but I translate not, you know, from French to English, although I do sometimes do that. But instead, primarily translate other people's experiences into an academic or a legal or policy language, or even a kind of lay language that, you know, people who have power and influence will be able to appreciate.
There's a term that comes up, which I realize that sort of starting from talking about a term might be a bit unorthodox, but I also feel like it goes along with your framing of the introduction of your book, where you know, your book is aimed at, the way that I understand it, for those who take conversion therapy to be a bad thing. And you use this, a particular word that I am familiar with, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the importance or sort of how you came to use this, and that's transitude.
Yeah. So transitude's an interesting word. So it just means, you know, being trans, a state of being trans, and is, you know, synonymous with transness, and transness would be the one that's most commonly used. And really, honestly, the reason why I use it is it's prettier. But how I came to use it is that it's the word that we use in Quebec a lot. It's a word that's been developed in the Quebec context as an alternative to the French transidentité or trans identity. And, you know, it was a way to differentiate, you know, ourselves from France, and sort of as we developed our own trans communities in Quebec. But then I started using it in English because there's so much that comes to Quebec from English. There's really this very Anglocentrism in Quebec in terms of the sources we get, because almost everything is written in English. And, you know, I contribute to that because, you know, the reality is there's the interest within Quebec is much smaller and the impact is much larger if you write in English, because the impact is much larger in English because you know, most people in Quebec can read it anyway, and people outside of Quebec can also read it. So there's most of the kind of like cultural production that people have access to in Quebec is from outside Quebec and is in English. And so for me, using transitude in English is really a way of trying to stand against this unidirectional relationship and try to show the value of what we can develop in outside of that, you know, Anglophone context. And so it's this idea of like, you know, we're bringing our to you instead of it always being the other way around. And then also, I mean, this one's silly, but there's also linguistic backing for that, which is like, purists see it as bad form to mix Greek and Latin roots, and so it would be transitude.
Thank you so much for that. I didn't know that it was that you were drawing on French or on French language in Quebec for the use of that. I found it such a compelling framing to talk about the state of being trans or of just being trans in a way that didn't necessarily rely on defining oneself by cisgender stuff. I don't know. I found it a really, it was just this very sort of subtle move that you did. Then I found it so, so deeply meaningful.
I like making up words.
it's a really useful framework. For those who are not familiar with the Ontario legal context and or the Canadian legal context, could you talk a little bit about Bill 77? Because this is a bill that really seems to form a lot of the concrete basis for a lot of the interventions you make in terms of, you know, suggesting these very practical legal and or policy changes. So if you could talk a little bit about what it is and also what you see this bill as actually doing.
Yeah, so Bill 77 is Ontario's bill that bans conversion practices, and it's the first bill in Canada. It was passed in 2015, and in the book, I use it as sort of like the example bill when I do my analysis. And the reason why I centered it is, I mean, the first reason is I had to pick something. But then the other reason is it's really the only bill that truly centered trans people in the legislative history. And to my knowledge, that's still the case, because most bills really center like conversion practices targeting cisgender queer people, and then sort of add gender identity and expression as an afterthought. And even though, you know, yes, they do mean to include trans people, much of the narrative surrounding it and the evidence they present before the legislature and all of that is very centered on cis queer people. Yet, trans people matter too, and also trans people disproportionately experience conversion practices and also tend to have a different experience of it because it's often much more offered by licensed professionals and healthcare professionals compared to cisgender queer people. And there's also some evidence that it's on the rise for trans people. And so by centering Bill 77, that was important for me because it meant centering trans people. Really undoing that tendency to center, you know, to decenter trans people in these experiences. And then also, it also tells us a whole lot more because we have that legislative background that explains, you know, what they want these laws to cover. And I do think that these bills are fairly broad and include, you know, all sorts of practices, including broadly practices that try to prevent youth from like growing up trans. So practices that are really kind of geared towards finding some sort of like pathological reason why the kid is trans and then trying to like discourage them from being trans, which is something that was done in Ontario a lot and was part of the reason why they ended up passing the bill. Like that was one of the I think the motivations for the community push for a ban, is that trans people were, and especially trans youth, were being pushed into a clinic that tried to prevent kids from growing up trans. Now, people at that clinic denied, and largely, as far as I know, continue to deny that that amounts to conversion practices. I'm still extremely confused as to what their reasoning is slash would be, because that just seems like textbook conversion practices. And in fact, looking at the law and you know, my I think second chapter is really dedicated to analyzing that question. And I think I make a very compelling case that's very much covered by bans. So that was kind of like the background of why I chose to focus on Bill 77. It's also a fairly, even though it is exemplary in its legislative history, it's rather unexemplary in its actual wording. It's fairly run of the mill. And, you know, that has its benefits because it makes it much easier for that bill to stand for all of the other ones in my analysis, because it kind of looks like all the other ones. So that's not a bad thing. I mean, it certainly has made my job much, 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 much easier. Like just how little originality there's been in across the board in terms of bills. I think the Australian Victoria government is the closest we got to something that's original and really centered survivors, but that's not really in my book because it is relatively recent and I just didn't have the opportunity to integrate it. But, you know, I did some, I mean, I sort of talk about it like quickly, but I didn't, you know, I couldn't do a full analysis at that stage of the revisions. But, you know, for the most part, there's really little that I could say is like original or groundbreaking that's being done there. And that is unfortunate, to say the least, but makes the analysis easier.
Before I ask you a question about the really in-depth, thorough, fascinating analyses that you do of different kinds of bans, you have, I mean, throughout the book, we talk in bits and pieces. Well, not I shouldn't say necessarily in bits and pieces, but because it's a significant part of the first chapter. But about, you know, thinking about the idea of, okay, what is a conversion practice? Really trying to lay it out to create some kind of definition. So I was wondering if you could spend a couple of minutes explaining how you think about, or how you would perhaps not necessarily define, but describe conversion practices.
Yeah, it's, to an extent, it's a fuzzy referent because there's sort of a spectrum, you know, in the literature sometime, like in a recent paper that I did with co-authors, we distinguish, you know, attempts at conversion from conversion services. And depending on how you kind of define those, that can lead to very, very different responses. I would say there's kind of like multiple features. The first one is it's fundamentally defined by its goal. So what conversion practices do is really sort of attempt to either prevent someone from becoming or being not straight, not cis, and not gender conforming. Some, including myself, would include attempts to, quote unquote, what they call normalize intersex bodies, which, you know, really need no normalization. Those are perfectly fine bodies. But those would also be included to I think conceptually it makes sense to include them in conversion practices, although politically speaking, they're often kind of separated out for various reasons I'm not necessarily going to get into. But so conversion practices are really this idea of making someone a sort of like gender normative and sexuality normative subject, either by preventing them from becoming non-normative or by trying to, you know, change, discourage, or repress the way they currently are. So that's kind of the aim bit. And then one thing that I think is kind of, you know, something that's peculiar to conversion practices is, well, it has to be more than just run-of-the-mill, you know, trans antagonism or homo antagonism and just like prejudice. Like there has to be, you know, it's not just the imposition of conversion ideology, it's a conversion practice, or in the more common terminology, quote unquote, therapy. So there's this idea that it has to have this degree of systematicity. Like it has to constitute a practice, some sort of systematic effort. Like it has to be a sustained effort that deploys a certain understanding of what would make someone change or be prevented from becoming. So it's not, you know, so it's not just we don't want that, but it's we don't want that and we apply techniques that we think is going to lead the way we want. So there's this systematicity to it. And I think those are like the kind of like two big components of what makes conversion practices.
Something that I found really, really I mean, I found a lot of things fascinating in your book. I took so many notes, was so excited about it because it's so grounded, it's so practical. It's really, I hope it does really lead to changes here, because there's so much in here. In your third chapter, you talk about different approaches to bans in a variety of different jurisdictions. I was wondering if you could talk maybe a little bit about what you found in different places. Speaking for myself, I was so surprised on some of the similarities and some of the major differences in terms of how the bans were worded, or what some of the reasoning was even behind it.
Yeah. So one thing I found is just how common it was that they just like borrowed from language that was in the American Psychological Association Task Force report on appropriate responses to sexual orientation. And they essentially like create this list of exclusions being like, you know, conversion practices don't include this. And it's things like, oh, helping create an integrated personal identity or something like that. But the problem is like, it's really decontextualized, and unless you know that it comes from the APA report, then you don't have the context, and then you're very prone to misunderstanding what that means. And in fact, we've seen a lot of people have kind of like banked on these ambiguities to claim that their conversion practices are not included in the ban. And the reality is that by and large, that's not true. The problem is that you have this language that's relatively unspecific and is divorced from its source that provided so much context. You know, for instance, the integrated personal identity one. Well, when they're talking about that, they're thinking about how to respond to, you know, religious gay men, for instance, who don't want to be gay because of their religion. And the kind of response being contemplated is to try to help them find a way to be religious and within their religion while being gay. So notably, one thing that that's been talked about in the literature that's suggested is the idea of like helping someone like look in, for instance, the Bible and show how actually it's not, there's nothing against being gay or being queer in the Bible. So like really working on people's understanding of how they can be both gay and religious, gay and Christian, and how these aren't in conflict with one another. But decontextualized people are taking this passage on integrated personal identity as meaning things like, celibate gay, or, you know, hate the sin, not the sinner kind of logic. And that's, or in the trans context, they're saying, oh, well, you know, we're helping you integrate within your sex assigned at birth and your quote unquote natal body. And so they're using that logic, and I'm like, well, that's not what this passage means. But if you don't look at the context, that's easy to miss. And I think that's like kind of a problem with a lot of the laws is that they just kind of like took this language without necessarily thinking in the ways in which it could create loopholes. Language that was in a report that was just not meant to be copy-pasted into a law. You know, that's just not, it was never intended to be used that way. And they probably would have written things differently if they had. Because writing, you know, a psychological report and writing a law is just not the same kind of exercise. So that's the first kind of like similarity, is like they kind of, almost all of them include either that or some sort of like homebrew variant. The second thing is, when you look at them from like, how do they mean the enforcement and who did it target? Well, a lot of them only target licensed professionals and thus kind of give free rein to unlicensed professionals and to more purely faith-based groups, which is quite tragic for the around half of survivors who experience conversion practices from non-licensed sources. So that's one of the concerns, but then some get a little bit more creative with that and look at it from a consumer protection standpoint as a sort of like fraudulent consumer practice, which has been a good way of getting it to work in the US. Another way that they do is sometimes they bring it under the scope of human rights law, like in Victoria, and then they allow people to lodge a complaint and an investigation instead of through the professional licensure scheme, through human rights processes, which tend to, even though they are often under-resourced, tend to be much more accessible than like a lawsuit, like suing someone for professional negligence. So those are, I think, you know, interesting ways of approaching things that are a bit more original. And then some of them take the criminal law approach, like now the Canadian government, and I've never really been subtle in my view that I don't believe in criminal law, I don't believe in carceral solutions, and I don't think that, not only am I against them on principle, but I think they're actually really disempowering to survivors and can actually make it extremely re-traumatizing to go through that process, because you're putting the power in the hands of cops and prosecutors rather than survivors themselves.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Building on... Sorry, I'm going to take a drink of water. Building on what you just said, something that I found really powerful throughout your book that I think I don't necessarily see emphasized enough, at least in my opinion, is that conversion practices don't just target, you know, trans youth, but also, you know, a range of youth who might not fit into, I don't know, particular idealized categories of gender, but also adults. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the scope of that, because throughout this book, it's really clear to me that you're talking about, you know, a described set of practices that can impact, you know, a wide range of people.
Yeah. So one thing that's a mistake is to think that that conversion practices are sort of uniform. They're really not. One thing that's important to understand and emphasize is that conversion practices is really a really large set of related practices. It's not all the same thing, and it's not all done by the same people in the same way to the same people. So that's the first thing to really understand. We're talking about a really broad family of approaches. So one of the things that people get wrong is first that it's only on youth, or that it's like only wrong when it's on youth and that consenting adults should just do what they want. Well, the first thing is it's about 50-50. So in Canada, particularly, it's about 50-50. If we look at more international data, it starts leaning a little bit more adults, but it doesn't depart like too much from 50-50 in terms of minors versus adults. So a lot of it is actually done on adults, and a lot of the data that we have for the harm that it does is data from adults, many of whom ostensibly consented. And for many, a couple, you know, notes here is, as first, just because you consent to something doesn't mean it's not harmful. There's a reason why we don't let doctors sleep with their patients, because it's too risky, too dangerous, regardless of consent. So in general, law has never been really never accepted this notion that everything is fine so long as you consent. You can't consent to harm, for instance, under most laws. Now, of course, there's more nuance than that, but that's still a general principle, is that just because something is consented to doesn't suddenly make it okay. There's other ways in which something that is consented to can be wrong, and notably when it's harmful. And conversion practices are harmful regardless of ostensive consent. Why? Well, first, because people consent for all sorts of reasons are usually maladaptive. They're afraid for their job, afraid for losing their family, afraid of being disowned. They're afraid for their own future and safety. They're afraid of a world that's gonna, you know, harm them for being trans, or they get sort of manipulated or even coerced into it by being told, hey, if you do this therapy with me, like, and go through it, then I'll maybe let you have medical transition, right? And they frame the conversion practice as a sort of assessment, extended assessment prior to being offered gender affirming care. And then they use that to kind of get them into the conversion practices. And that's, you know, that's just a way that they kind of like get people to consent. Another way is by not telling them what you're doing, because, you know, people who do conversion practices don't call them that. They're not telling you we're doing conversion practices. And so many people like just don't know. Many of them do know, but also many don't. And so that creates a very serious issue in like how much we can trust consent. And then there's also just the fact that, data doesn't show that it, like data hasn't shown that consenting somehow makes it not harmful. So the harm is still an ever-present risk. And then you also have to ask yourself, like, what would be someone's non-prejudiced reason for wanting conversion practices? Like, this is all rooted in the idea, either directly or indirectly, that there's something wrong with being trans, that there's something wrong with being gay, something wrong with being bisexual. If we didn't have those ideas, nobody would come to try and get conversion practices. So that's sort of like the first, that's sort of like the issue of the adult line. Also, one thing to notice is there's a huge spike around the ages of 18, 19 in the data. So around like, we're talking about like a quarter of people who undergo conversion practices do so in either 18 or 19 years old. So really, really huge spike around that age, which just goes to show how much it preys on like vulnerable young adults who just reach the age of majority, are usually leaving the family home and now have to kind of like come in contact with a social world that's not supportive of queer people, and that often, sort of preys on their vulnerability to manipulate them into conversion practices. So there's also, that problem with using a stark line between adults and minor, which is, well, yes, but they're usually preying on young adults. So, it kind of defeats the purpose if we exclude adults. Then the other one is, this idea that like, oh, well, we can just ban it for, sexual orientation. We don't need to ban it for trans people. The first thing to note is, well, first of all, pardon my French, but fuck you. We'll see if they cut that in editing. So that's the first point. Yeah, trans people need protection too. But then also, it would be a mistake to think that trans conversion practices don't actually harm and target like cisgender youth, like cis queer youth. One of the people who spoke a lot against the UCLA clinic that did conversion practices was a sociologist Carl Bryan, who's currently a professor of sociology. And he is a cisgender gay man, and yet, he explains, the study and the therapy that I received made me feel that I was wrong, that something about me at my core was bad and instilled a sense of shame that stayed with me for a long time afterwards. And he says, he's not, he may have found a place of happiness today, but that is in spite of his experiences, because those were extremely traumatic experiences. And it didn't matter that he ended up not being trans. The fact of the matter is that you're having a practice that fundamentally teaches you that there's something wrong with being yourself. And that if you were trans, that would be wrong. And oftentimes that targets gender nonconformity. So you're teaching someone that it's just something wrong with being gender nonconforming. You're teaching them that your love and acceptance of them is conditional. And that's incredibly traumatic. And oftentimes the practices are done by discouraging gender nonconformity, right? And it's interesting that if you look at the UCLA clinic, you have kind of the Recursiva Lovas crowd, and then you have like Green, and then Green influenced the practices of like CAMH. And Rekkers wanted to prevent people from becoming gay or trans. The idea was like, they're both sort of a negative developmental outcome from being gender nonconforming. And so we must repress gender nonconformity so that people don't become gay or trans. Then I've moved on to people like Green and CAMH, who were of the view, well, actually, we think it's fine for people to be gay, but we think it's valid to prevent people from being trans. So we're going to try to prevent people from being trans. But the thing is, they're still the same practices. You know, yes, one is more strictly behavioral and one incorporates much more psychoanalytic and cognitive approaches. But a lot of it is still the same practice of discouraging gender nonconformity in the hope that it's going to make someone not trans. To the kid, that's, you know, a distinction without a difference to say, oh, well, it's okay because we're not actually trying to prevent you from being gay. We're just preventing you from being trans by stamping out your quote unquote effeminacy, right? So there's a need to understand how these practices actually operate and how often they actually target kids who are, you know, don't purport to be trans, or kids who, you know, think they might be trans, but, you know, grow up not to be, but all still get targeted and harmed by those practices regardless, right? So it's really important to kind of like appreciate that, I think, which is trans conversion practices are applied to cis and trans people. And if you don't include like gender identity and expression in your law, not only are you fucking over trans people who have a disproportionately high rate of conversion practices, but you're also fucking over all the cis kids who will be, you know, caught into those practices and be traumatized and be harmed and in many cases die by suicide because of it.
I just wanted to quickly interject that CAMH is the Center for Addiction and Mental Health Gender Identity Clinic for Children and Youth, which has since been closed down, just for those who are not familiar with that acronym.
They were closed down amidst allegations. So they were engaging in conversion practices and following a report that pointed out that they could not confirm that they didn't engage in conversion practices and that much of what they did certainly sounded a lot like it. So they decided to close the clinic in that context. Also known as the Jurassic Clark, because it used to be known as the Clark Institute before.
I could ask you so many questions about this, but the last question that I'll pose to you is that something that really strikes me throughout the book, and perhaps this is just the legal anthropologist in me talking, is the social impact of banning conversion practices on social norms, but also really thinking about different ways to go about stopping these practices, not just through a ban or a law, but also through professional organizations and education. And you have tremendous experience in engaging on a variety of projects around this topic. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, the importance of education and professional organizations in, you know, intervening and ending this practice, but also, you know, how would you imagine, you know, an ideal consultation or an ideal engagement in really, you know, ending this?
Yeah, I mean, so unfortunately, there's a lot of, there's no way to do things perfectly. There's no way to completely eradicate conversion practices so long as cisnormativity and heteronormativity exist. What we can do is our best. And that means, you know, professional association taking very seriously their role of not just pointing at conversion practices and saying, oh, that's not allowed, because honestly, that's lazy. That doesn't tell your members the message. Like, you need a much bigger pedagogical platform. You need to integrate that into your education curriculum. You need to, you know, have that be mandatory knowledge from the earliest possible so that it's integrated in the professional identity. And not just the saying no, but actually knowing what conversion practices look like, and having a an effective enforcement mechanism for it, because unfortunately, you know, a lot of the time people say, oh, that's not allowed. But then there's, you know, if it happens, there's very little you can do because there's no effective enforcement mechanism in place. And the reality is a lot of professional associations are in denial about the role that licensed professionals have in conversion practices, because they think, oh, it can't be happening among our members because these are our peers. We know them. We believe in it's happening among you. Like I said, like about half of conversion practices are, you know, licensed professionals. And if we add things like counselors, teachers, and people like that, you were going even much, much higher in terms of the percentage. Like, this is being done by people who have positions of authority, who have oftentimes professional bodies licensing them. And so really having effective work at that level would really do a lot to reducing the rate of conversion practices. Wouldn't remove all of them, but it's certainly a lot. And unfortunately, I think associations don't have the willingness. They don't want to put their, what's the expression? Put their money where your mouth is. You know, they want to do things quick. They don't want to do things right.
That is, I think perhaps a good way to end our conversation for today. Florence, if people want to find out more about your work, where should they look to find you?
Yeah, so you can follow me on Twitter. My handle is @butnotthecity, because I'm Florence, but not the city. Otherwise, you can go to florenceashley.com to find more information about me, about my work, and find all of my publications. And I encourage you to get the book. There's many places you can get it on the internet. I'll let you, you know, find it. Much to my dismay, it seems that the cheapest place is on Amazon. But I'll let readers figure out where they want to find it.
I will add links on where to get your book when this goes up online. I want to thank you so much for your time today, Florence, both because this is a really, really important, really practical, really thorough intervention, and also just to thank you as a trans person for doing this really, really important work.